From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And we'll start this hour in Tennessee, where Obamacare appears to be in big trouble. This week, the commissioner of the state's Department of Commerce and Insurance said the state's health care exchange market is very near collapse. Commissioner Julie Mix McPeak signed off on severe rate hikes intended to stabilize the system, but now Tennesseans buying insurance on the exchange could see their premiums soar by as much as 62% next year.
I know that we are talking about significant dollars to Tennessee families, and I don't take that lightly at all. But I think it is a worse situation not to have any option available.
We're going to talk about the national picture in a moment, but first let's get to Tennessee and Emily Siner, who covers this with Nashville Public Radio. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
Well, is it true that the system is very near collapse? And if so, why?
Well, it's definitely strained. Insurance companies say that they've been losing money on people who buy insurance on the exchange ever since the Affordable Care Act went into effect. This portion of Tennesseans is apparently less healthy than insurance companies expected, or they go to the doctor more. So essentially, insurance companies say they budgeted wrong. They didn't charge enough for premiums in the first place, and now they're losing a lot of money. And some insurers have already pulled out of the marketplace in Tennessee, like United Healthcare is no longer going to be on it next year. There are only three companies left. And the commissioner says every insurance company that leaves just puts more strain on the other companies, and it kind of increases the risk that that will cause every insurer to leave.
Every insurer to leave. Right now, the one insurer that operates statewide is Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee. So what happens to people who see their premiums go up? Do they have any other options, or are there some people who only have one?
Yeah, about half the state next year will only have one option, which is a big difference from this year, where every county in the state has more than one option. So a lot of the state will not have any sort of competition or any way to compare prices. For consumers, if you look at the sticker price alone, it is pretty tremendous. For example, a 35-year-old living in Nashville who buys insurance with Blue Cross Blue Shield would pay $518 a month next year, up from $332 a month this year. So that's a really dramatic jump. But according to both the state and the Department of Health and Human Services, the vast majority of people who buy on the exchange don't pay the sticker price. A lot of people qualify for subsidies based on income, and that sort of just depends on each consumer. A report released this week from the Department of Health and Human Services says that 83% of people in Tennessee will actually pay less than $100 a month, which is obviously more manageable, but it just kind of depends on a number of different factors.
Have the insurance companies or the state given any guarantee that this rate hike will work, or is it possible that there will be more big premium increases like this in the future?
It's definitely possible. I mean, they say that the goal is that this will allow insurance companies to break even next year, so they won't lose money, and therefore they won't leave the exchange. But it entirely depends on who actually signs up for the marketplace and how much they go to the doctor and how healthy they are. So if a greater number of people go who cost a lot, then the insurance companies might still lose more money, and in which case it could keep sort of spiraling.
That's Emily Siner with Nashville Public Radio. Emily, thanks.
Thank you.
So what does what's happening in Tennessee mean for Obamacare as a whole? For more on that, we're joined by Sarah Cliff, senior editor at Vox.com. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
And is Tennessee the only state that's having problems like this, where the system is said to be very near collapse?
It is not. You are actually seeing pretty widespread reductions in competition in Obamacare next year. One of my colleagues here and I, we actually just released a new analysis yesterday, which shows that one in four counties that use healthcare.gov are on track to have just one insurance carrier in 2017. And that's a big change. And kind of some other numbers to put this in perspective. Last year, we had just had one state that was only served by one insurance carrier. Right now, it looks like we're going to have five states that will have just one health plan. And so Tennessee is not actually in that group because they have some insurance plans that sell in parts of the state. These are five states that, you know, the entire state just has one insurance plan to choose.
And what went wrong?
So I think these are some of the issues that have already come up, is that the people who have signed up have been sicker than insurance companies expected. I think right now you see a lot of finger pointing at the individual mandate, which I'm sure a lot of people remember from some very fierce debates and a Supreme Court decision, that the requirement to buy insurance was not nearly strong enough, that the fees, which are $695 for the entire year are much lower than actually buying insurance. So you've kind of it seems like we've seen a lot of young people who are healthy just sit out the market, and then the insurance companies end up with enrollees who are much sicker than they expected, and all of a sudden the premiums don't cover the medical costs.
So what's likely to happen now? I mean, are insurance companies willing to try to work this out and fix it? We already saw Aetna decide to pull out of a number of states when it comes to Obamacare, but are insurance companies trying to fix it? Are people trying to fix this, or are we just going to watch the system collapse?
So it really varies a lot insurance company and insurance company and state to state. One of the things, you know, would like to mention is you have some states that are doing great, like California or New York or Texas actually have a lot of insurance companies. They have really vibrant insurance markets. And this was true before Obamacare, too, that these are big states with big populations, urban areas. They're very attractive to insurance companies. The states that are struggling tend to be lower income states, states with more rural populations where insurance companies don't see as big of a business opportunity. What you generally see happening is I don't expect collapse of the marketplaces. Instead, it looks like we're going to have a lot of insurance markets that are served by just one carrier, usually a Blue Cross Blue Shield plan, and that patients will have somewhere to get care, but they won't have the choice that Obamacare promised them.
And as we see in any industry that consolidates and one player is in the game, the prices are going to go up. We talked about that happening in Tennessee, but I imagine that means some people are going to lose their health insurance because they won't be able to pay those premiums.
Yeah, that definitely is the worry of having markets with just one carrier. And, like was mentioned earlier, these subsidies in Obamacare do really help. About 85% of people using Obamacare are getting a subsidy from the government. So they're not really feeling those rate hikes as much. I think actually, where there'll be a tension point is the government, because the government subsidies are going to keep going up and up and up. And you can bet that Republicans next year are going to say, wait a minute, why are we paying all right. these exorbitant premiums to insurers?
Sarah, we just have about a minute left, but I want to ask you, we're talking about the system that exists right now. What if there were no Obamacare? Would we have seen premiums go up as much as they have or even more without the system that was put in place?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think the answer is yes. There's actually some research that suggests premiums have gone up lower than expected with Obamacare. And I think, to add on to your question, we'd also have 20 million fewer people who didn't have insurance. So it definitely is true that Obamacare has increased the number of Americans with coverage. We have the lowest uninsured rate in decades. At the same time, the place where it's really seems to be failing right now is providing consumers a good choice of which plan that they enroll on.
That's Sarah Cliff, who oversees health coverage at Vox.com. And Sarah mentioned her new article about Obamacare. We will link you to that at hereandnow.org. Sarah, thanks as always.
Thank you so much.
You might remember last month we spoke with U.S. Air Force Captain and Iraq War veteran Tim Finley. He was just about to head to Mongolia to compete in the world's longest and toughest horse race, the Mongol Derby. 600 miles, 10 days, 25 horses. Well, Captain Finley's back. How'd he do?
I did well. I placed 13th out of 43. But really, to be honest, crossing the finish line was everything.
Finley is a tough and experienced rider, but he says Mongolia's horses are even tougher. He was thrown the very first day of the race.
I pancaked onto the ground, onto my back, and it was agony. Agony. And I was covered in dust, and I look up at the horse, and I'm seeing stars, and I've got Mongolian dirt in my mouth. And at the time, I was in the lead. And I thought, no, I can't. I can't stop. I can't take a break. I've got to go. It was the first day. I only had three names on my shirt when that happened.
Captain Finley wore only one shirt for the entire 10 days of the race. And every time he got on a new horse, he wrote the name of a U.S. military veteran who's taken his own life on that shirt. And in Mongolia, it was their memory that pushed him to the finish.
I knew I was riding for them. The pain that I went through physically and the endurance that was required to cross the finish line, I think sets a prime example, because endurance racing is, in fact, a perfect metaphor for what they're dealing with, for what I had to deal with. Because the very last horse I rode, I named after myself. And that was the one horse that crossed the finish line. And when I think about that, that really hits home. To think that if they had some kind of a solution like this, that maybe their name would have been the last name.
U.S. Air Force Captain Tim Finley spoke with us from Fort Riley, Kansas. We've got pictures of him crossing the Mongol Derby finish line at hereandnow.org. Language, integration, and politics. The three are colliding in Austria, where Sebastian Kurz, Minister for Integration and Foreign Affairs, has proposed offering migrants jobs that pay only 1 euro an hour until they learn how to speak German. 1 euro, by the way, is about $1.13. So should governments enforce language standards, especially one language standards? And can immigrants ever fully integrate if they don't learn the majority language of their new country? These are long-running questions that are taking on a new significance. Well, Mairead Nick Krath is an anthropologist and chair in European culture and heritage at Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh, Scotland. She joins us. And first of all, what do you think about the Austrian official's suggestion?
I understand where it's coming from. It's coming from this perceived need that migrants need to learn the language of the state. But I don't agree with it because there are so many things that come into play in learning a language. And it also implies that the language skill is essential to a job, which is not always the case today.
Well, so the language skill may not be essential to a job.
No.
And particularly perhaps the kinds of jobs that they're referring to, 1 hour and 1 euro an hour serving food. One would question how much German they do need to know in the camps. But Austrian officials are saying that in order to fully integrate or assimilate into Austrian culture, learning language is a key part of that.
Yes. That is not so unusual, really. I mean, this instance happens to be Austria, but it's very much based on a 19th century model where many countries in Europe and France and Germany went down the route of one language, one nation. And this idea that your marker of belonging was the language you spoke. I mean, they interpret it slightly differently, but the idea was that a group within particular boundaries would speak the same language, and that somehow or other speaking the same language meant they had the same values, they had the same customs, they had the same cultures, and that they would be cohesive in a way that would be effective in the world. I mean, I think that's a model that's changing nowadays with migration and with movement that has increased so much in the 20th and 21st century. I think that model no longer holds, but it certainly was there for a long time.
But let me press you on this a little bit, because I take your point about the history behind this thinking.
Yeah.
But that also involved one language. Whereas, I mean, isn't it possible here that Sebastian Kurz in Austria is suggesting that, you know, we're not saying that you speak German exclusively, but that you learn German alongside your native tongue?
Yes. But I think my problem with that kind of model is there is somehow an implication that no matter how many languages you speak, unless you speak German, you can't do the job. So it's kind of ignoring the fact that a lot of these migrants may have multiple language skills, which might be just as valuable as the German one. So the issue is the value we place on the different language skills. And certainly I have no problem with a model which is German plus. I mean, the EU model really is every citizen should speak their mother tongue plus two more. So it's the idea that in the world of the 21st century, we should all be able to speak several languages as a matter of routine. But the implication in the Austrian model is that without German, you are deficient, regardless of how many languages you speak.
Well, perhaps my line of questioning, to be perfectly honest, is informed by my own background here a little bit, because, you know, I am the child of immigrants to America.
Yeah.
And my family was really, at the time, so focused on assimilation.
Yes.
That in our household, they spoke exclusively English. There was this idea that in order to fully become part of the culture that you were coming to, that you couldn't do that without being able to speak with your neighbors, without being able to communicate not only, you know, your needs, but who you are. That it was the best way to be not an other in the country that you were adopting.
Yes, and I mean, even though I am an immigrant now because I'm Ireland living in Scotland, but I mean, my background would be the same. I mean, I lived in a country where during the famine a lot of people gave up the Irish language and learned English in order to become part of the empire. And the idea again was one language. There was somehow the notion that if you speak two languages, you will speak neither of them correctly. So you better drop your native one in order to learn the other one. So I think a lot of people reacted to the idea that if they wanted to belong, they needed to speak the majority language only, rather than speaking the majority language along with the other languages. So somehow the language becomes the yardstick or the marker of your assimilation. And I think also, just on the word of assimilation, I mean, in the old days we talked about assimilation where everybody blended into the main culture. And then with politically correct language, we started talking about integration rather than assimilation, the idea that we would have more of a mixture going on. But really, we're back to the assimilation model now, I think.
Isn't a secondary concern or a secondary issue here sort of the long-term effects, not on the nation so much, but on the immigrants to that nation and their lives, the long-term effects of being linguistically isolated?
Yes, and I mean, I think that is true. I mean, there's an instrumental argument here which says that really, in order to connect, people need to speak the host language or the majority language. The issue is, though, of course, that if they use the language with which they came, it's perceived somehow as threatening or as not belonging or not wanting to belong more significantly.
Is there a way that you imagine that a government could encourage language integration without stigmatizing the immigrants? Because I think that's sort of the pushback here.
It is, yeah.
What's happening in Austria?
Yes, it is. I mean, there are some good examples happening now where countries are thinking about, in inverted commas, teaching the migrants the language of the country in a new way where it's much more of an equal partnership. So what is going on is one person teaching the migrant the language, but then the migrant also teaching back something about their own culture. To give an example of that, one scheme is a gardening scheme in Germany, where they call it something like putting your roots down. And basically, migrants and locals garden together. And in the gardening together, they get to know one another. Migrants have an opportunity to plant plants from their own country. So there's an exchange of information and ideas about plants, etc. And then they also cook and eat together. And that's a very different model from the image we have of the local or the native in front of the classroom teaching a bundle of migrants the language they need to learn in order to get jobs. So I think that kind of blended model or blurred model, as I'd call it, is a much better way of dealing with things. While it's a question of getting them to learn German, it's also a question of how can Germany best use the languages they bring with them for the benefit of the country as a whole. But another example would be my home country, Ireland. We have a scheme called Foilte, which means welcome. And in that scheme, they take older people who have perhaps retired, but who are still very active, etc. And they pair up older people with migrants to mutually learn from one another. So again, it's not one informing the other. It's a mutual companionship. And again, seeking to help the migrant, but also help the local people understand the migrant as well, because a lot of the fear that goes on is fear of the unknown rather than fear of what they actually know.
Well, I wonder if we could just take a step back here for a moment and talk about what it is about language that is so powerful in defining groups, and in this case, perhaps in opposition to one another. I mean, why is language so critical to how we perceive who is one of us versus not?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think, you know, for a lot of people, language isn't critical. For most of us, we wake up in the morning, we don't think about the language we're going to speak today, and we don't think about the implications of that language. It's when there's a problem arises that suddenly the language becomes critical. So maybe when we see a lot of migrants coming in and hear different languages, we feel threatened. Or maybe, you know, if a language is dying out, it suddenly becomes very important. So, I mean, I think think in a way language has become routine, habitus is what somebody called it, and we just don't think about it. But if you're in a place where your language isn't allowed or where you're being encouraged to speak a different language, then it suddenly becomes really, really important. And I think it's because communication is a vital part of life. I mean, our lives are stories, and we tell our stories through language. And those stories that we carry in our language are not just our own stories, but they're our family stories, our histories, and our communal stories, and our nation stories as well. So they're all passed on through language.
Right.
So I think that's why it's so important.
I mean, just to circle back to where we started, because this is such a thorny issue. I mean, do you think that migrants or immigrants to new countries, if they don't end up learning the dominant language of the nation that they're coming into over a period of years, decades even, and I'm not saying that they have to speak it exclusively, but if they don't acquire that language, aren't they at a long-term disadvantage?
Well, it means that I think they are, because it means they are dependent on someone else, unless the services are provided in their language. I mean, a lot will depend, for example, on whether you're in a country that offers services in many languages or just the one. But if you're in a monolingual country or a largely monolingual country and you don't speak the language, then you are dependent on somebody else to apply for your passport, to go to the post office, to do your shopping. And I think that is not a good situation to be in. So I think there are very valid reasons for asking migrants to learn the language of the host country. My argument would be just that there must be room for more than one language.
Well, Mairead Nickrath is an anthropologist and chair in European culture and heritage at Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh. Many thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, so they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. There's no weekly commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
American women's soccer star Hope Solo has been suspended from the U.S. women's national soccer team for 6 months after comments she made when her team was eliminated from Olympic play in the quarterfinal. The U.S. lost to Sweden, which went on to win the silver medal. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, first of all, what did she say?
She said that, well, before the games even started, she got a lot of attention for making a gigantic deal out of Zico, which is certainly something to worry about. But she did it in a fairly insensitive way, wearing, you know, kind of stereotypical anti-mosquito netting and things like that. Mm-hmm. Then after the game, she just revealed herself to be a poor sport. She called Sweden cowards. She said the better team, meaning the U.S., lost, and Sweden were cowards just because they played a totally acceptable form of soccer that actually got them into the gold medal game. So that was really churlish.
So you're not allowed to say something like that? It's just considered unsportsmanlike?
Well, it certainly is unsportsmanlike. And after the gigantic favorites that were the United States, one of their most high-profile players was expressing sour grapes. All the rest of the team was saying that, you know, that doesn't represent us. I think the U.S. Soccer Federation said that that doesn't represent us. But it's not just this one thing that she said. She has a long history of giving headaches to the U.S. national soccer team. In 2014, she was arrested for an assault on her nephew and sister. And then there was an incident when her husband was allegedly driving drunk, and the van he was driving was the U.S. national team's van. And she has often said things that create a headache for the United States team, but she's such a good goalie that they want to keep her in goal. And so maybe this was the breaking point, even though really she's being suspended. And we could talk about what that actually means for speech. It might not have been the speech that they wanted, but it does seem just, if we were taking it just on the basis of what she said after the Olympics, punishing someone for 6 months based on post-game press conference comments that weren't offensive to ethnicity or gender or nationality, but were just sour grapes.
And that suspension, that 6 month suspension, do you think, based on what you were just talking about, that those other previous transgressions played into that suspension? Are they allowed to do that? Or was this about this one thing?
Well, Sunil Gulati, who runs U.S. soccer, he has wide discretion on this, and it certainly played a part. On the other hand, you could say one other thing that might have played a part is she is among the several female soccer players who are actually suing U.S. soccer because they say that their pay isn't equitable with the men, and on many data points, they are correct. Now, what will the suspension mean? They only have two. The U.S. women's team only has two games scheduled, so she'll probably miss those games. They also pay her a yearly salary, which amounts to about $150,000. So half of that is losing about $75,000, plus they get a couple thousand for each game they played. However, she gets a salary for playing for her club team, and that salary is paid for by the U.S. national team. The U.S. national team thinks it's in their interest to have their players playing on the Pro Women's Soccer League. She'll still be able to play for Seattle, her club team. That salary will still be paid by U.S. soccer, it's been reported.
So a future in soccer for Hope Solo, despite all this?
I think, but, you know, she's getting old, and that was always, well, not old, but in terms of professional right. athlete standards. But that has always been, like so many athletes, it doesn't matter what she says, as long as it's not so far outside the bounds, that her talent will keep her on the roster. And that is getting less and less true as time goes on.
Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
California lawmakers have until next week to approve major changes in the way future elections might be run in that state. Senate Bill 450 would allow for a major expansion of mail-in ballots, and if counties opt in, which they would need to, thousands of neighborhood polling sites could be replaced by voting centers in locations like downtown business districts. Californians could also register and vote on the same day anywhere in the county, not just on election day. California's election system was recently ranked least efficient in the nation by Pew Charitable Trusts. In contrast, Colorado is ranked number 6. A few years ago, Colorado adopted the same kind of mail-in voting and vote centers that California is now considering. So let's start with Los Angeles County Registrar of Voters, Dean Logan, who's a supporter of SB 450. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Great to talk with you.
So first of all, explain to us why this bill has come up in California now.
The dialogue in our state legislature really came after the last gubernatorial election where we saw near record low voter turnout. And so I think that started a dialogue about the mechanics of how elections are run in California and if there is something about that process that could be improved, and really recognizing that the decades-old model of voting that we currently operate under is falling short in that regard.
Interesting. So let's talk about some of the specifics then that are proposed in SB 450. I mean, first of all, there's the strong move towards mail-in ballots or an expansion of absentee ballots. Can you talk about that?
Right. So in California, for many years, we have had no-fault absentee voting, or what we now refer to as vote-by-mail, because you don't have to be absent. In that respect, we have many counties, especially in the northern part of the state, that have more than half of their registered voters are signed up to be permanent vote-by-mail. What SB 450 does is expands that to a broader audience where we would be mailing vote-by-mail ballots out to voters. But in addition to that, we would augment that with in-person vote centers located throughout the county where voters could go to any one of those locations over a 10-day voting period or to vote their vote-by-mail ballot. So it really expands the access and the options that are available to the individual voter.
Well, regarding those vote centers, I'm seeing some concern, especially in L.A. County, that if this plan fully gets rolled out, that there would actually end up being too few vote centers in comparison to the number of polling places L.A. County has, and that given all the traffic problems in Los Angeles, that maybe that would actually make it tougher for people to get to these voting centers.
It's a fair concern in terms of access. We need to be very cognizant of areas where there's more difficulty with public transportation or where we have low propensity voting populations. But I think the bill does allow for us to, for instance, create mobile or pop-up locations. So again, we can actually take that voting infrastructure and put it in a place where we know there's high traffic.
Right. I'm seeing the example of putting a mobile or pop-up voting center at the Rose Bowl, for example.
Exactly.
Now, what about the perennial worry, whether it's borne out or not, the worry is there about if we change the way we vote, we might crack open the door to more ballot theft or fraud.
I actually think this model reduces the potential for fraud or just administrative error in the election, because it allows for a more focused staffing model where issues can be resolved on site, as opposed to here in LA County. I mean, we're this incredibly large jurisdiction. On election day, we employ over 25,000 poll workers at 4,800 locations throughout the county. I think that the vote center model and the vote by mail model actually allows for greater control. And also, just the reality is that we know that the system we're using today is not meeting the needs of all of our voters.
Yeah, I'm seeing that turnout in LA County in June was roughly 40%, one of the state's lowest.
And that's actually a pretty statistically pretty high turnout for LA County in an even year primary.
And finally, I just want to ask you one more question about the sense of whether or not people trust the current system and would they trust a new system? Because I'm looking at a study done by UC Davis's Civic Engagement Project, and they found that young voters and Latino voters both used voting by mail less frequently than other voters in California. And that, in fact, according to the LA Times, Latino voters in Los Angeles County were among the least likely voters in the state to cast ballots by mail because they simply didn't trust that their ballots would arrive where they needed to and be counted. Now, I understand that these vote centers would exist and people could go vote in person. But if part of the streamlining and efficiency that SB 450 promises to bring relies on a lot of people voting by mail, isn't that a major obstacle that you have to overcome with a huge number of California voters?
Well, I actually think that's an important point about this bill. Is this is not a bill to move entirely to vote by mail like Oregon and Washington or even Colorado, where they have the vote centers, but they have high percentage of voters voting by mail. I actually think that the vote center model responds directly to that research about Latino voters and younger voters in terms of offering an in-person voting experience that is more similar and more consistent with the way that those populations function.
Well, Dean Logan is the Registrar of Voters for Los Angeles County. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, as we mentioned, Colorado made some of these changes back in 2013. Then it became one of only three mail-in ballot states, and Colorado's turnout rate is now double that of California's. So let's see how things have been going in Colorado with Megan Verlee. She's a reporter at Colorado Public Radio. She's been covering these election changes. Megan, good to have you back on Here and Now.
Hi, Megna. It's good to be back.
Well, first of all, you heard what Dean Logan said there about California and LA County. Based on what's happened in Colorado, what do you think California can learn?
Well, I thought it was very interesting what you were talking about at the end of the conversation there about voter trust in their ballots actually being counted. And one way that Colorado has really been trying to foster that is by rolling out ballot tracking websites. So, you know, when I drop my ballot in the drop box in October or early November, I'll start getting messages from my county clerk saying, hey, we got your ballot. Hey, we've opened your ballot. Hey, we've counted your ballot. The other thing that California will find itself facing is a lot of questions about preventing voter fraud with mail ballots. And Colorado has a very robust signature checking system. They bring in the journalists every 2 years to show how they check the mail ballot signatures against on-file signatures from the DMV, for instance, trying to reassure people that nobody can go and just, you know, steal a bunch of ballots out of mailboxes and fill them out and drop them off and get those counted.
Yeah, interesting. So this idea of fostering trust in the system, really, really important. How 3 years after Colorado passed these changes, how do most Coloradans vote? Does everyone vote by mail now, or can they still go to a polling place?
Well, we have vote centers, as California is considering. So every county has to open a certain number of vote centers. What's kind of interesting is we call it an all-mail ballot system in Colorado. It's really an all-mailed-out ballot system. So everybody gets their ballot in the mail, but almost two-thirds of folks, at least in our large counties, go to drop boxes. And vote centers now are, my understanding is, primarily used either by people who haven't registered in advance. So they come in, they register, they vote there in person. People who've spilled a cup of coffee on their ballot and need to toss it out and get a new ballot. And then they also serve accessibility issues. So disabled folks, the blind.
And I see that most Coloradans can also register to vote online, which voters in 39 states cannot do. So how have these changes in how Coloradans vote, do we have a sense as how they might impact this presidential election in Colorado?
Well, I think this is one of the most interesting things. The law that moved us to all-mail ballots and vote centers was a Democratic bill signed by a Democratic governor. Well, the first election it was used in, 2014, we had a Republican oust an incumbent Democratic senator. And when the number crunchers went back and looked, it appears that shifting to all-mail ballots may have actually benefited the Republicans, because even their low-propensity Republican voters were voting in a higher amount once they were given that easier ballot access. So looking at this year's presidential election, I'm already starting to hear from Democrats that especially the Clinton campaign is going to have to work very hard to make sure that its constituencies are returning these mail ballots. You look at the Democratic coalition, it's younger folks, millennials and Latinos. Those are two groups of people who tend to be more mobile. And if you don't update your address in an all-mail ballot state, that mail ballot doesn't get to you. You can get shut out of the process.
Well, Megan Verlee is a reporter at Colorado Public Radio. It is always so eye-opening to talk with you, Megan. Thanks so much.
Oh, well, thank you.
The Interior Secretary, Sally Jewell, is at Yellowstone National Park today to celebrate the 100th birthday of the National Park Service. She'll be giving a speech later tonight at Yellowstone's iconic Roosevelt Arch. And someone else with a very close connection to the Park Service will also be speaking. That would be Stephen Mather McPherson, whose grandfather was the first director of the National Park Service and one of the people who got it going in the first place. I spoke with Stephen Mather McPherson when we broadcast the show earlier this week at Yellowstone's Old Faithful Inn.
Stephen Mather was an industrialist living in Chicago, and he, fortunately for him, he'd made a substantial amount of money, and he was able to break away and go into public service. And he called the Secretary of the Interior, who had gone to the University of California with him, and told him he was doing a lousy job running the national parks. And the Secretary said, come to Washington and do it yourself. And he took the challenge, went to Washington, became the Assistant Secretary of the Interior, and then in the summer of 1915 took industrialists, writers and congressmen, and on his own money, out to the Sierras and took them on a pack trip. And those influential men came back to their various places and helped him in the next year get the Park Service Act passed by Woodrow Wilson on August 25th of 1916, so it's coming up on 100 years.
100 years ago this week. So what do you know about why he cared so much about the parks?
He had grown up as a young man in San Francisco and had spent a lot of time in Yosemite National Park and the Sequoias. And so he had seen how badly they were run, how poorly they were administered. There was logging going on. They were running cattle. They were mining in the parks. And these parks are supposed to be unimpaired for future generations. That's in the act, actually. So he got very disturbed about that, but went on to make a fortune for himself and then had the ability to go and perform public service. That was his dream, and thank goodness he did so, because we're all the beneficiaries.
And you yourself have also been involved in the parks throughout your career. Tell us what you've done.
Thank you. I served as a seasonal ranger here in Yellowstone National Park in the summer of 1958, and was on patrol here. Had a wonderful time working with other rangers. I've subsequently, as I grew up and became an adult in business, I served on the board of the National Park Foundation. I was chairman of the board of an organization called the National Parks Conservation Association, which my grandfather founded in 1919 to bring in the minds of industrialists, academics, and scientists to help him build this new agency in the Interior Department. And that has evolved into a huge citizens organization which provides support to the parks.
And do you have children?
I do.
And are they involved in the parks?
Oh, they're all fascinated. They're all here with me for this celebration, which is going to take place this on Thursday. We're really looking forward to all being together at this 100th anniversary.
Do you think we'd have the national parks? Do you think we'd be standing here on this porch at the Old Faithful Inn, which, fair enough, did exist even before 1916, but do you think we'd have the parks without your grandfather?
I think we'd have something. We'd have some administrative group. I don't know whether it would be shaped quite the same way. My grandfather had an assistant who stayed in the government by the name of Horace Albright, and he was helped my grandfather throughout the 14 years that he was the director, became the second director himself when my grandfather died. He became the superintendent here in Yellowstone. So these two guys really drove the whole process, and I don't know if it'd be different, certainly, but it might have similarities.
What's your favorite one of the national parks?
This here in Yellowstone and Grand Teton. I spent a lot of time here as a kid, and then, of course, being a seasonal, that was very influential in those days for me. I took a train trip across the United States in 1946 with my family, and throughout that trip, and when we stopped at national parks, there were men there who had known my grandfather, and it was very influential to me as a young kid. But Tetons and Yellowstone are my favorites.
And if there's a kid listening to this, someone young who's never been to the national parks, what would you tell them?
I would tell, get your parents to get you in a car and drive around this country, just like the people that we see here at Old Faithful today. They're one that's filled with families and kids, and they'll take a trip that they'll never forget.
That's Steve McPherson of Florida, whose grandfather was Stephen Mather, who was one of the people that really started the national parks and was the first director of the National Park Service about 100 years ago. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Great pleasure to be with you.
And we spoke the other day at the Old Faithful Inn at Yellowstone National Park, and Stephen Mather's legacy can still be found at some of the most beautiful spots in the National Park Service. Mather Point at the south rim of the Grand Canyon is famous for its sweeping views of the canyon, and Mount Mather is a 12,000-foot peak that stands tall in Alaska's Denali National Park. And the rugged Mather Pass cuts through some treacherous mountain terrain in California's Kings Canyon National Park. And while we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service today, be sure to take a listen to the sounds of Yellowstone, some of the animals and natural features there as recorded by audio archivist Jennifer Jarrett. We brought you some of those sounds earlier this week. You can find them at our website, hereandnow.org. And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.